You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. On the heels of International Women's Day, we're looking at the immense progress women have made and the work that's still undone in pursuit of the equality that women fight for every day. First, some good news. More girls are in school than ever before. More countries have reached gender parity in school enrollment. And over three quarters of countries now have legislation to tackle domestic violence. What is the most pressing issue that women face today? What significance has the women's movement had in your life? We're at 800-642-1234 through the hour. Kelly Wills is an associate professor of communication at UW-Stevens Point. She teaches courses on women and gender studies, and her recent book is called Resisting Rape Culture Through Pop Culture. Kelly, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
And Valerie Barsquet is a history and international studies professor at UW-Stevens Point. Her teaching and research areas include East Asia, the cultural history of Okinawa, women and gender studies, and theories of the body and embodiment. Valerie, welcome to you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, Valerie, let's start with you. Yesterday was International Women's Day, and March is Women's History Month. What significance do these days and months have?
I think, especially for women on an international stage, it's a chance for a sense of solidarity. We know, of course, that this movement began in Russia in protest against World War I, and there were definitely women who were beginning to understand themselves on an international stage. And I think that's the main point about equal rights, women's rights, and a sense of solidarity.
Do you find that we have solidarity around the world? Do you see women in other countries having parallels to what women face in the U.S.?
Indeed. I think the question of whether you have workplace equality, whether you have rights about how women use their bodies, other questions about the way in which women have access to health care, these are all things that women in the U.S. face, and certainly you see that on a global stage as well.
Kelly, what impact do you see on days like International Women's Day or Women's History Month? What does it mean to you?
I mean, for me, it's always a reminder, and I hate to be the depressing one here, but how far we haven't come, especially in the U.S. If we look at ourselves, we still rank 75th globally in terms of female political representation. If women earned minimum wage for their unpaid labor, so the work they do around the house or caring for relatives or childcare, they would have earned $10.9 trillion. And that is the equivalent to all the money made in 2018 by 50 of the biggest companies in the world. In the UK, for example, one in three boys don't believe that girls should have the same right to education as boys. And this is 2020. And as many have pointed out, too, with the most diverse field we've had in the Democratic primary, this contest is now between men in their late 70s. So I think we still have a bit of a ways to go.
Well, Kelly, let's talk politics a bit more. Here is Senator Elizabeth Warren last week addressing the contradiction she experienced while running for president.
If you say, yeah, there was sexism in this race, everyone says, whiner. And if you say, no, there was no sexism, about a bazillion women think, what planet do you live on?
So there's the juxtaposition. Kelly, what do you make of what you heard from Senator Warren?
So I think when we talk about gender in politics, we tend to focus on women. But actually, I believe that constructed masculinity is sort of the big winner of 2020. So if you go back a ways, we've seen politicians feminize each other to sort of tear down their credibility. And we've almost always nominated the most traditionally masculine candidate in the field just for decades. So since the 1980s, the right has really successfully painted Democrats as feminine by linking liberalism to weakness, dependence, helplessness. So progressive politics and policies like care for the environment, LGBTQ rights, government regulations of corporate behavior, those have all been cast and framed as feminine and therefore weak and ineffective. So environmentalists, for example, are cast as tree huggers. So liberals and progressive already are feminized by virtue of their policy stances, which is why it doesn't surprise me that the last two men left standing are the quote-unquote most masculine in the field on the left. So for Senator Sanders, you know, he's gruff in his presentation. He embodies this sort of tough New Yorker, scrappy vibe. And many scholars have noted that the Democratic Party has not nominated a presidential candidate with that sort of masculine, like, street cred and since Lyndon Johnson, actually. So while Sanders may be saddled with the sort of same feminized policies or liberal candidates have, he's able to navigate that within sort of this frame of this hyper-masculine and then is more sort of palatable to the public. If we look at Trump, for example, he still very much uses hyper-masculine tropes to feminize and criticize candidates on the left. We saw this in 2016 when he made fun of Little Marco, quote-unquote, when the Republican primary literally devolved into men screaming about the size of their hands and genitals to prove their masculine prowess. Most recently, we saw him going after Bloomberg for his height as a way to take him down a notch as well. If Trump had a way to feminize Sanders, I think he would, but he hasn't figured out how to do that yet, so we're left with quote-unquote crazy Bernie. He does manage to feminize Joe Biden by calling him Sleepy Joe, referring to his senility or another form of weakness. But because we have for so long conflated presidential with masculine and have for so long done this, I don't see how Warren ever really stood a chance. She was plagued by this sort of schoolmarm persona and never found a way to perform the appropriate degree of both masculine and feminine traits to be taken seriously. And I think until we reject that framework, I don't see how a woman ever gets elected to president at any point in my lifetime. Clearly, her campaign had flaws, as she did, as they all did. But I think this factor played a larger role than most would like to admit.
Talking with UW-Stevens Point professors Kelly Wills there and Valerie Barsquet, they teach courses on women and gender studies. Gathering your thoughts, what are your thoughts on the Democratic presidential primary that started with a diverse field of candidates, now down to two white men? How do you feel about that? What do you think holds back women presidential candidates? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Cindy now in Appleton. Hi, Cindy.
Good morning. Well, I would just like to say I think we've taken a lot of steps backwards. Women are losing their reproductive health care rights. We still don't make the same amount of money as men unless you're a union employee. And one thing I'm sure you will not talk about today is all the missing and murdered Indigenous women who still to this day, dozens of them disappear every year.
Cindy, thank you for bringing those themes up. Valerie, what do you hear out of Cindy and the fact that Cindy says women haven't made that much progress?
Yes, thank you for that comment, Cindy, and for the fact that you're mentioning Indigenous women. Some of the issues that the women I deal with in Japan and Okinawa face are some of the historical issues like you're raising to remember how women have been treated in times of war. One of the big issues is to remember comfort women. That's a euphemistic term for these ways of international sexual slavery and the way that women are treated in conflict. So for what I'm hearing from Cindy is that we need to continue to fight for some of these historical issues as well as the current policies that we are facing. And there's an intersection there to think about what has happened historically and what continues to the present. So I, of course, echo Cindy and Kelly who are saying we're not there yet. In the case of Japan, we have not seen a woman who's ever been elected to the highest position of power. There is a woman who's trying to get to succeed the next prime minister, and the way they're using her politically is also in an interesting feminized way. They want to remilitarize Japan, have a full get rid of Article 9, the article in the Constitution that says they cannot have a standing military, and they use women that they put on the Ministry of Defense to say if women acknowledge it, if they say that it's okay for candidates that are nurturing and defined by their womanhood, then it must be a good thing to remilitarize.
We're exploring women's social and political struggles through the hour. Valerie Barsquet and Kelly Wills are professors at UW-Stevens Point. You can join in. What questions do you have about the women's movements of past decades? Were you involved? What can you share? How have you seen the world change since the Me Too movement? We're at 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about women's equality here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. International Women's Day allows us to take stock of how women are doing, and it's a day when women have risen up and protested, putting their lives at risk to demand equal pay, to defend human rights, fundamental freedoms. And the day's been celebrated for over a century. When you think of the plight of women around the world, what comes to mind? How do you think the actions and decisions you make in your life impact the lives of other women? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kelly Wills and Valerie Barsquet are professors from UW Stevens Point. They teach courses on women and gender studies, and they're spending the hour with us. Let's take another call now. Whitney is with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Whitney.
Hi.
What's on your mind about International Women's Day?
So my question for the speakers this morning is, what types of roles do they believe race plays in this conversation? As a Black woman, a topic that I've heard discussed a lot lately is the type of care that women are receiving pre- and postnatal, and the high number of deaths of Black women postnatal that are kind of being overlooked, and it's kind of alarming, and I just wanted to hear what they had to say about that.
Whitney, thank you so much. Whitney brings up maternal health. Kelly, what can you tell us there?
I will say it's definitely an issue, and the problem with a lot of these conversations is that feminism for a very long time focused on the issues of white upper-class women. And so when we're not talking about other women, we are forgetting extremely large portions of the conversation. So the caller is absolutely right. Doctors, as like with all of us, have inherent biases. And so until we are taught to challenge those biases, we are going to treat people differently. Doctors, for example, assume that Black women have a higher tolerance for pain, so they're less likely to get prescribed pain medication. In terms of childbirth, they are less likely to be taken seriously and have a lot of complications. And so it's not because the doctors are evil or mean. It's because, again, we have these subconscious biases, and we never have thoughtful conversations about race and gender. So when would we even have the time to think about our own bias that we've been trained to see and not see within these conversations?
Valerie, what is maternal health like in Japan?
Oh, maternal health in Japan is a complicated issue because women, of course, are struggling to make sure that they have representation in the government and in health policies. And so oftentimes women's voices are not taken seriously for understanding their own health care. At times you even have doctors that don't tell women directly what kind of issues or diseases that they're facing. And so the caller makes me think of Bell Hooks, who was speaking back to Sheryl Sanders and what she calls faux feminism, to this idea that if white women of a certain class could just lean in more, then we would have better equal rights or we would have better representation of women. But Bell Hooks speaks back and says that doesn't apply to all women, to women of color. And Bell Hooks says we need to dig deep rather than lean in. And I think that's true for women's health issues in the U.S., but also I've seen that in the case of Japan and other parts of East Asia.
We're exploring female movements over the years. UW Stevens Point professors Valerie Barsquet and Kelly Wills join us for the hour-long conversation, and they teach courses on women and gender studies. You can join in at any point. Do you talk with your kids about Women's History Month? What do you focus on? Do you discuss inequality and what it means? Are you an activist? Tell us about the work you do at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Valerie, you've researched in Japan and the islands of Okinawa for years. Can you tell us about bicycle citizenship and the way it connects to women's political participation?
Yes, thank you. My undergraduate advisor, Robin LeBlanc, was a Fulbright scholar. That's how I was able to get two Fulbrights to Japan as well. And she has an amazing book about the role of Japanese housewives in political participation. And she uses that term, bicycle citizens, to contrast the image of male-dominated politicians who drive around in their fancy air-conditioned taxis when it's women who navigate political spaces on bicycles, quite literally. And so she talks about how housewives of Japan actually do have a political world. It just often isn't seen or experienced through the lens of male-dominated views of the world. And so this idea of bicycle citizenship really sets up a gendered understanding that there are other ways to to navigate political understandings and political society.
Kelly, do you see that theme of women in politics, women in power, that those workarounds, adapting to the circumstances in order to find some successes?
I mean, again, it's this impossible double bind, right? So a candidate has to be equally feminine enough and masculine enough to be taken seriously, which is just really impossible to do, right? And so we see if a woman is too masculine, she's seen as cold or calculating or robotic. If she's too feminine, we see like the Sarah Palin treatment where she's hypersexualized, where there's pornography made of her. And so again, until we sort of reframe how we understand politics as not having to be so hyper-masculine, I don't know how any woman works around that framework, because it's so just part and parcel of how our country sort of understands these things.
Valerie, let's talk about dance for a moment. You study theories of the body and have researched how performance is a type of activism. Why is dance a significant form of protest in Okinawa?
Yes. In Okinawa, they have been colonized. They were under Japanese colonization, and then quickly at the end of World War II, and we're coming this year, is the 75th anniversary of World War II and the Battle of Okinawa. And my students are working on a public exhibit to talk about this complex history. And in that context, dance was targeted as backwards, as feminized, as an example that you weren't civilized under Japanese colonialism. And so there were dances that were banned and not allowed to be performed by Okinawans. So in the post-World War II era, these women activist groups, women like the Okinawa Women Act Against Military Violence, they have reclaimed performance to reclaim bodies. There's a famous example in 1995, just after the famous Beijing event for women for the UN, that there was a rape of a 12-year-old girl in Okinawa by three U.S. Marines. And in response to that, these women said, we're going to do something different. We're not just going to be throwing our fists in the air. We're going to express ourselves with movement that recalls this colonial violence and that understands how we might move forward for girls and women in the future.
So there is a dramatic art to this type of protest. Do you see the artistry in it?
Absolutely. In fact, I've trained in some of the dances with these women, and it's a very complex, some of them come from court dances, and the artistry specifically tries to create a sense of what it means to be a woman in a different historical context. And this also, it doesn't negate the fact that they understand women can be part of violence. Women are part of, just as Kelly is identifying, maintaining some of the systems that we wish to challenge. But it does recognize that some understandings of how you grapple with peace, of how you combat issues of post-colonialism, has to be done through women finding their own voices and using, at times, their bodies to say something different.
Kelly, when you look at activism here domestically, the protests, the sit-ins, demonstrations like the Women's March or Black Lives Matter, what effect do you see that having for inside the movements and for activism?
So I think, I mean, looking historically, even to the 1960s, here's where I see us still having not made enough strides. So in the anti-war movement, women were still left out of leadership roles, even on the left. And so that sort of rejection grew to form their really own consciousness-raising efforts. For example, during that time, gender roles were still really prevalent. And so, you know, the man and woman would both go to a protest, wipe the tear gas out of their eyes, and yet she'd still have to go home and make dinner, right? And so I think there are remnants of that today, even in parity within leftist movements.
Is there now a social media or online performance of activism? What do you see there?
Absolutely. So we've seen historically, you know, the use of hashtags and how technology has really changed social movements. I think it's important to remember that even before the Me Too movement, there was the Yes All Women movement. So this was in response to when Elliot Rodger did a mass shooting and essentially created a manifesto on how because he was entitled to sex and wasn't getting that he was going to take his revenge out onto the world. And when that happened, we feminists were saying we need to start talking seriously seriously about misogyny and mass shootings and the role that gender plays in this, because they've been talking about it for decades. And the response to that was hashtag not all men are doing this, right? And then in response to that, a Muslim woman actually started the hashtag yes all women, and it sort of flew off from that. Within a day, she deleted her account because she was getting so much harassment and violence. And we forget, too, that that was started by a Muslim woman and then co-opted by white women in the very same way the Me Too movement. People thought it was started by Alyssa Milano when originally it was started by Tarana Burke. And so, again, if we look at an intersectional lens through all of this, we see the ways in which white feminism has sometimes co-opted these movements. And we really need to sort of pin down and make sure that doesn't keep happening.
We're looking at women's issues and the challenges for equality throughout society. We have Kelly Wills, an associate professor of communication at UW-Stevens Point. Her colleague, Valerie Barsquet, a professor of history and international studies. And you, do you talk to your kids about Women's History Month? What do you focus on? Do you discuss the inequality that persists? How do you explain it? What do you say to your girls? There's room for your insights, your questions. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue this conversation right after this news update here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for joining us. Organizers of International Women's Day hope this year's theme will inspire others to challenge biases, question stereotypes, and celebrate the achievements of women around the world. The theme is hashtag each for equal. It runs all year long. So have you seen progress? Do you see a need for movements to address more issues and be more inclusive? Are you an activist? Do you attend marches? Tell us about what you're speaking up about and how your voice is carrying. 800-642-1234. You can tweet us, WPR Mornings. We have UW-Stevens Point historian Valerie Barsquet and communication scholar Kelly Wills guiding us through our discussion, and they teach courses on women and gender studies. So according to Pew Research, in 2018 midterms, more than half of voters were women. And let's hear actress Michelle Williams discussing women's political participation at this year's Golden Globes Awards.
Women, 18 to 118, when it is time to vote, please do so in your own self-interest. It's what men have been doing for years, which is why the world looks so much like them. But don't forget, we are the largest voting body in this country. Let's make it look more like us.
So, Kelly, what strikes you about her speech there?
So, again, she was making a point about abortion rights and reproductive justice, but received quite a bit of backlash from some women and feminists. And the criticism that I saw is that her statement sort of failed to highlight the reality that plenty of white women have been voting in their self-interest forever. I mean, 54% voted for Trump, which some would argue is a vote to protect whiteness, white supremacy, and maintain patriarchy. And have been voting to protect their whiteness in every election. If you look at, you know, Kay Ivey, the Republican governor of Alabama, that's a woman who signed into law the single most punitive abortion law in America, making providing an abortion a felony, punishable with up to 99 years with no consideration for incest and rape. I would argue Kate Ivey thinks she's voting in her self-interest, and to ignore that is to ignore a large swath of the population.
So, and also, too, you see white women of privilege and then women of color that don't have the same privileges and perhaps are on completely unequal footing there.
Correct. I mean, again, for a lot of black women, they have been voting in their self-interest for a very long time and trying to sort of upend these structures and work against these power structures. But, I mean, again, if women truly voted to upend patriarchy, we wouldn't be in the structure we are now. But enough women are complicit. And part of this is because I think many white women seek to attain status and power through, you know, voting for whiteness and voting for patriarchy in a way so that they don't feel so marginalized.
Valerie, can you introduce us to Takazato Suzuyo and how she went about advocating for women's issues?
Yes. So Takazato Suzuyo is an elected official in Okinawa, and she was one of the founding members in 1995 of the Okinawa Women Act Against Military Violence. She was also one of the 1,000 women who were group nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize in 2005. And she is a woman who says, if we as women and politicians and activists do not support women and find ways of raising funds for women's issues specifically, who's going to do it? So she is, of course, been seen protesting and marching with labor unions and other kinds of male-dominated groups, but her argument is, I can't give my time and my money to things that aren't specifically focused on bettering the lives of women, because if I don't do it, who's going to do it? So she's been a very powerful force, and she has resonance. She's been protesting in New York. She works a lot with people at Columbia University, and she also has a presence in the Philippines, where the U.S. military has left environmental destruction sites and areas where women are greatly affected by the presence of U.S. military bases. So her argument would be, if women don't do the work to fight for women's rights, to speak to what Kelly said, to say, figuring out what is that issue of intersectionality, what comes first? Is it about understanding ourselves as women, or understanding ourselves as Okinawans or white women? Those kinds of questions she's pushing to say, understand women as women and fight for women's rights through that venue.
What have her roadblocks been? Where has she seen challenges to her agenda?
Mostly the challenges have come from the fact that the island-wide protest that is for peace is still, by and large, dominated by men. And sometimes those voices can be very dismissive to women and can ignore that and can choose to give funding and to give voice and space to male-dominated forms of protest. And so she continues to navigate that by trying to raise funds in different avenues, by going internationally, having her voice heard abroad. One thing I think that's important when we think about intersectional identity is the ways in which white feminists and feminists in the U.S. sometimes have the inability to see the role of women of color in other countries as important and significant. I know that I have students who sometimes don't understand that, for example, women in Muslim countries who choose, and it's an agentic choice, to be veiled, are somehow oppressed or suppressed in their own countries. But if we look at places like Indonesia, the largest Muslim, most populous Muslim country in the world, they have elected females to the largest top position to be president. Pakistan, Bangladesh, Turkey all have had successful elections of women to the highest office, and yet the U.S. has not. And so I would encourage us to remember that part of intersectionality as U.S. feminists look abroad, to understand that there are women who can be successful in their own cultural context, even if we're not able to create that space for women here.
Talking with UW Stevens Point, Valerie Barsquet and Kelly Wills, they teach courses on women and gender studies. We're taking a step back after International Women's Day to look at female movements through history and across countries. What questions do you have about the women's movement of past decades? Were you involved? What can you share? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Kelly, let's look a little bit closer at intersectionality of movements worldwide. And first of all, can you describe what that word means?
Yeah, so I will preface this by saying I usually spend a semester on this term in my own classes. So I will give you the really quick and dirty definition for our listeners here. It's essentially a metaphor for understanding the ways that multiple forms of inequality and disadvantage sort of compound themselves and create obstacles that are not often understood within conventional ways of thinking about anti-racism or feminism or other social advocacy structures. I ask my students to use a lens sort of metaphor. So it's a lens for seeing the ways in which various forms of inequality often operate together and exacerbate each other. So it's not simply that there is, you know, a race problem here or a gender problem here or a class problem here. Many times that framework erases what happens to people who are subject to all of those things. So I'll give you two examples. So the first example The women's movement in the 1960s was comprised mostly of upper-class white women. Betty Friedan, one of the leaders of the movement, referred to lesbians as the quote-unquote lavender menace because she thought that including them in the movement would take away from its credibility. In addition, non-white women didn't have the luxury of the problem with no name that Friedan had discussed in The Feminine Mystique because they weren't bored housewives. They were usually working 2 to 3 jobs and didn't have the luxury of protesting and not working. An intersectional lens would ask us not to just look at the women's movement as a monolith, but factor in race, sexual orientation, class, et cetera, to see how injustice plays out when you have multiple marginalized identities. Another example is voting rights. So the 19th Amendment only gave white women the right to vote. Over the course of hundreds of years, black women had to pave their own road to voting rights. We learn about Susan B. Anthony, who devoted her life to women's suffrage and who knew that the ballot was a key element in helping women become more equal. But we forget our history when we forget that she didn't believe all women merited that right. Susan B. Anthony famously said, "I will cut off this right arm of mine before I will ever work or demand the ballot for the Negro and not the woman," quote unquote. Mm. This exclusion of black women from the women's suffrage movement and our lack of history and conversation about that reality reflects how the intersection of gender and race has historically affected different groups and their path to voting rights.
We have an email here from Matt in Wausau and said, "I voted for women up and down the ballot. Look at Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand. Women can and are effective leaders. It's a shame. It will take at least another election cycle to realize this." Valerie, what can we draw there when you look at these intersections about women who do run governments and women who are in politics and able to achieve, break through that glass ceiling?
Yes, there are several examples that women are able to come to these high positions of power. Even in the case of Japan, even though they haven't been able to elect a prime minister, we do have, for example, the governor of Tokyo, who's leading Tokyo through all that's preparing for the Olympics and all that's happening right now with the pandemic. Koike Yuriko is a woman who's come to power and is able to achieve that. Of course, there's an intersectional issue. In her case, she is tied to a strong sort of neo-nationalist party, and so a lot of that comes with policies that are about following what the current prime minister is trying to accomplish. But there are ways in which women do come to power, and of course, as women who have all different kinds of interest, as Kelly is highlighting, and experience intersectional forms of discrimination, simply because a woman comes to power and able to be successful doesn't mean that those intersectional issues go away, right, or that they're not also finding ways in which their policies don't help all women that cut across race and gender and sexuality and class across the board.
Yeah, so you really have to look at a multitude of issues to really understand where women are today, not just here in the U.S., but around the world.
Indeed, you have to. And in the case of Okinawa, that's really acute because they consider themselves in many ways not to be Japanese, certainly ethnically and in terms of cultural history. So the idea that somehow a woman in power in Tokyo would represent the voices of women in Okinawa just is not necessarily the case. And I think that's the kind of thing that Kelly and that Matt is also coming to, some of our callers alluded to today. That's the kind of issue of intersectionality that we're discussing.
We have UW Stevens Point scholars Valerie Barsquet and Kelly Wills. They teach courses on women and gender studies. This hour, we've been tackling a range of women's issues that hit home. What are your thoughts about the fact that despite the most diverse presidential primary field in history, only white men remain in the race? Are you concerned? What do you think holds women back in politics? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. There's more conversation in just a moment on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're looking at women's issues, at the social, economic, the cultural, the political issues of women straight across the globe and in our own communities. Over the past few years, Me Too has propelled the women's movement forward. In 2017, millions of women started using the hashtag Me Too on social media to speak out against experiences of harassment and sexual assault. Have you seen the world around you change since Me Too? Do you think we've given too much weight to high-profile cases like the Harvey Weinstein or the Bill Cosby? What questions do you have about women's movements in the past? Still time for your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Valerie Barsquet is a history and international studies professor at UW Stevens Point, and her colleague Kelly Wills is here, an associate professor of communication. So, Kelly, Me Too. We just heard the guilty verdict in the case of Harvey Weinstein not long ago. Do you see progress here? What is your take?
So, obviously, this is a positive thing, right? He did some pretty horrible things and is now, you know, being punished for those. But I think some of the critiques we see within the movement is that just taking down high-profile celebrities like Harvey Weinstein or Bill Cosby isn't going to do a lot structurally for the women who are most marginalized, the poorest among us. And so, again, most survivors do and will not have the amount of resources and support that Weinstein's victims have received. And so if we're not actually changing the structure, we're not protecting the graduate student who was harassed by her professor who needs to take his classes to move forward. We're not seeing help for the McDonald's worker who is sexually harassed by her boss who can't afford to quit her job. And so, again, some of those changes have to come at the structural level. Otherwise, again, we feel like these small wins are happening by taking down high-profile celebrities, when in reality, for most women in the country, they won't see a sort of a bit of change there. So it's important. And again, Me Too has changed the conversation. Like, that is significantly important to think about how we are speaking differently. But we also need to see policy changes that will affect everyone's lives and not just the ones who have the most amount of resources.
Do you think that it's the policy changes that will be the next chapter of Me Too?
I really hope so. Again, I think, like everything, you know, hashtags sort of ebb and flow, and people assume, oh, you know, Weinstein's taken down, everything's good, right? And so I think we forget that there's still so much work to do beyond just changing the conversation and having these high-profile cases. I think it can happen, but again, for policy change to happen, we have to have people who are aware of these issues elected in office, right? And so that's sort of an issue as well.
Valerie, how do we see the theme of fighting for bodily autonomy and against sexual harassment and assault? How does that play into international women's movements and what you see in other countries?
The issue of women's rights, especially at the level of body, has definitely resonates with sexual harassment, but also rape across the board. And some of these issues, the hashtag MeToo movement in Japan and in Okinawa has given some voice to that, allowed women to talk about these things. However, there's also been backlash to some of these women. Some of the women I work with personally in Okinawa who've come out and spoken about their experiences with sexual violence have then been bashed online. So some of this online bashing that leads to another kind of oppression and limiting women's voices, it is still a risk for women to come forward and talk about these horrific and very private experiences in public ways. So I second what Kelly is saying. It's changed the conversation. It's added a new component. However, there's still so many things to do culturally to allow it to really be safe for women to speak and for women to feel like they can break their silence. I also once again want to raise the issue that particularly in Korea, but also across Japan, that they're still fighting for recognition of institutionalized sexual slavery and the things that happen to women as servicing military. And that's not just an issue that happens in Asia. Those kinds of things continue. So I think as we remember commemorations of World War II, we also have to remember those kinds of complicated voices that suffered not just in combat at a high political level, but what we do to women's bodies on the combat zone.
And we're seeing this in corporate culture, too, where we see, like, men not hiring, quote-unquote, attractive women for fear of being called out and sexually harassed, right? We see women or men not meeting with women alone. Mike Pence will not meet with a woman on his own, and others have said, I don't want to get accused of these things, so I'm just not going to hire women or work with women. I have a colleague who said he will not advise young women because of all of these, quote-unquote, crying, rape, or sexual assault. And so there has been a huge backlash in terms of the hiring process and in our career-oriented society as well.
We're looking at Women's History Month, International Women's Day, Through the Hour with UW Stevens Point professors Kelly Wills and Valerie Barsquet. They're with us. Still time for you. What would you like people to think about this month? What significance does International Women's Day have for you? We're at 800-642-1234. We heard from Emmanuel in Strawberry Point, Iowa, emailed to say Emmanuel participated in the Iowa caucus this year. Of the 40 or so who attended Emmanuel's precinct caucus, 9 of us were for Senator Warren, 7 female, 2 male. Kelly, are we seeing more men looking at female candidates today? Is that what we need for a woman to win?
I mean, the biggest sort of conversation I heard was that a lot of people really liked Warren and liked her policies and her platform and her stances, but just didn't think that she could beat Trump or that she wasn't quote-unquote electable, which often is shorthand for having a Y chromosome. I mean, sadly, I think if Elizabeth Warren was a man, I think she would probably be still in the race right now, and people don't want to admit that. But we have a very hard time, especially with Trump. I mean, I think the number one question in terms of exit polling was, who do you think can beat Trump? And that was the way that people cast their ballots. And we don't know, actually, who will beat Trump, but people kind of assume that it has to be sort of a tough masculine guy to take on this other tough masculine guy. And so, again, in this instance, I don't think she ever stood a chance because of who she was. Again, that's reductive and essentialistic, and I realize that there's more nuanced conversations to be had here, but I think that was sort of the reality I saw.
Valerie, what does persecution of women look like in Japan, and in terms of, are women jailed, or how are they tamped down?
In terms of jailing of women?
Mm-hmm.
There's definitely ways in which in Okinawa, one issue that I'd like to raise is not only historical issues of sexual violence, but Okinawa traffics a lot of women from other parts of Asia, Southeast Asia, and East Asia to service current U.S. military soldiers and Marines as prostitutes. And so some of the issues that happen is women get persecuted and get placed in prisons in Okinawa, and they have no paperwork. They have no ability to return to their own countries. They get sort of trapped in this kind of international trade for sexual tourism. And so that's been a major issue that some of the women's groups, like the Women's Action Network in Tokyo and other places, have been trying to raise awareness and funds to support these women that come to Okinawa and other parts of Japan that service the U.S. military for this kind of sexual tourism. And so I think that's an issue of what happens when women are persecuted and they're not able to fight for their own rights. They don't have documentation. That's one issue I think that's been a major concern for women activists abroad.
Well, before we let you go, I want both of you to be able to have a few moments to say, what gives you hope? What makes you hopeful for the women and girls of the world? Kelly?
My students, honestly, they're absolutely amazing. They are so much more checked in politically than I ever was when I was 18 or around their age. And so, again, seeing the conversations they're having and seeing the thoughtful conversations and the seriousness with which they take politics and policy and being civically engaged, like, that really gives me hope for the next generation.
And Valerie, for you, where do you see the hope?
I echo Kelly, of course. My students are amazing as they're working on public history displays and looking at the voices of women. They're trying to understand war through gendered lens, especially talking also about masculinity. But my hope, I have to say, I'm currently living in a new situation of a multi-generational family. So I have an 8-year-old daughter and a 73-year-old mother. Oh. And I watch us at the dinner table, and we are very different women from very different times and cultural influences. And when I see the way that my daughter can talk about her own body, can talk about her place in the world. She's a bilingual child who understands things in different ways. She can use the term woke, not always correctly, but she's trying to understand these kinds of concepts. That's my hope. And that we don't leave those other generations behind.
Well, we have to leave it there. Thank you both so much. Kelly Wills and Valerie Barsquet, professors from UW Stevens Point who teach courses on women and gender studies. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.